This is Jan Revelle, and my interview today is with Deborah Annapol. Did I say your name correctly, Deborah?
You did. Thank you.
Oh, good. My first question to everybody is if you would tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe your background a little bit, and how you discovered your passion or your purpose, your calling, and what that is.
Okay. It's been a long and interesting journey for me of starting out in the 60s where as a teenager, the Vietnam War scenes on television made a huge impression on me. And I decided right then and there that this was not okay and that I needed to help discover a way to end wars. And that original purpose kind of evolved from being anti-war to pro-peace. And then I kind of realized that even the peace movement was not creating peace in the world, partly because the old stereotype behaviors for men and women were carrying over into the peace movement. And I didn't really like what I saw about the position of women within this. And so I became a feminist. And then I realized after a while that feminism wasn't really creating peace in the world. It seems to be... seemed to be adding rather than healing the war between the sexes. But at least I had kind of gotten clear that peace begins at home, and peace begins actually in the bedroom. Peace begins in the environment that children are raised in. And that led me on quite a journey, eventually realizing that no matter what we did in terms of supporting more nurturing and satisfying intimate and sexual relationships between men and women and improving communication, that in the end, it all comes down to consciousness. And in the end, actually, it comes down to my consciousness, because I can't really transmit anything that is not alive in me. So I started with a very outer-directed global kind of agenda, and in the end, just came home to my own heart and soul. And I had an interesting conversation with a friend the other day about this idea of life purpose. And he was feeling that he was kind of searching and floundering, not knowing his purpose. And I started talking about the distinction between purpose and mission. And I realized in my own journey, every time I thought, aha, I found it. And in that process of finding it, I took on a number of missions in the world having to do with relationships and sexuality and women's rights and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And those were all great things to do, but those were missions. And a mission is a fairly specific activity or agenda that it can make a great contribution to humanity, to the planet, but it's just by coming into form, it's actually coming from ego. And not everything coming from ego is bad, but It's a mission. It's an idea or a concept of what I'm supposed to do now. And I realized in explaining this that I'd come to recognize a distinction between purpose, which has more to do with aligning my individual self, my apparently separate self, with something larger than myself. Purpose is really about recognizing that we are all sparks of the divine, and as such, if we surrender our personal will to what you could call divine guidance, that whatever that looks like, and it can and very likely will change over the course of time in its manifestation. Manifestation is always changing, but that essential purpose of alignment with the divine never changes. And my friend found this really helpful, and I actually found it really helpful myself to get clear on this and to put it into words, because I've been living this for a while, but I still, in my mind, I was a little confused of how is it that I devoted all this time and energy to these things that I thought were important in the past and now don't interest me at all? I've moved on. I've evolved. And I'm constantly finding new expressions based on my current level of evolution for how I would show up in the world. And if I remained committed to a mission that was appropriate for me at one point in my life, but is no longer relevant, then I think I'd be very unhappy.
That makes a lot of sense.
Did your
friend come up with for himself this distinction between purpose and mission?
Yes, absolutely. And the friend that I was talking to, this was on my recent trip to Belize, when he had been young, he had grown a particular, he'd been a farmer. And one of the things he'd grown was a particular type of corn that was a very ancient indigenous corn grown by the Indians. And he found this corn was really easy to grow and naturally resistant to pests and very abundant. And these days, most of the corn that we have available to us is far inferior, even if it's not Monsanto's Roundup Ready corn. It's corn that's been bred for factory farming. Anyway, so he felt his mission was to find this corn seed, which he'd lost along the way. This was 30-some years ago. But to find this corn seed and to reintroduce it around the world, people growing corn who wanted an alternative to Roundup Ready corn. Now, that's a mission. And purpose is much larger than that. Purpose is not about a particular kind of corn. Purpose is about listening to guidance and seeing what am I able to do in this time and place that contributes to the whole. So for me, with my history, has been mostly about sex and relationships for working in that area for 40 years. And what at this moment I have signed up for is training the next generation, is passing on what I know about that. But and so that's a mission, and it's not my purpose. My purpose is to just keep listening to what's being asked of me now.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, I found it really, really grounding and clarifying to make that distinction between purpose and mission. And I think a lot of people get really caught up in looking for their purpose, that is, what am I supposed to be doing? And that's a great thing. I totally support people, yeah, asking the question, how can I make a contribution? But when we get our identity all tied up in that and we get really attached to the outcome, we're kind of getting off purpose. We're kind of putting some barriers in the way of really being open to guidance.
I'm looking at some of the questions that I want to ask you, and you're addressing them. So I don't even, like, one of them is, what is the meaning of life? And I realize that that is very much what you're talking about as far as purpose is concerned, is discovering your purpose in being here. Am I understanding you correctly?
Well, I would say that, yeah, whether it's understood or not might not make a lot of difference for some people. You know, the mind always wants to understand and wants to know. And, yeah, for some of us who have minds that are really active and really want to know, then, yeah, it's probably important to satisfy the mind's desire to know. And it's entirely possible that just by being present and tuned in and responsive to what's showing up in your life, that you might be much more living your purpose, and you might be much more satisfied with a sense of meaningfulness than if you're clinging to some illusion that you have about what you're here to do. This is kind of what I'm trying to say, is in my journey, yeah, I started out with ideas coming from the mind about what life was about and what would be meaningful, because I was always interested in what would be meaningful. But the mind's understanding of what's meaningful is not always congruent with the heart and the soul's experience of a meaningful life. For example, you know, the example that comes to mind, since I do work so much in the area of sex and relationships, is that a lot of people are very engaged in looking for their soulmate or their twin flame, or even just, you know, kind of a more mundane husband or wife kind of thing. And a lot of people have the idea that this is what's going to give their life meaning, is a satisfying relationship. And this is what's going to create happiness. And it's not necessarily true. And Madonna once said, if you think you've met your soulmate, run in the other direction. And what she meant by that was that, yeah, the soulmate is not Prince Charming come to rescue us. The soulmate is the perfect mirror who's going to reflect back with sometimes painful accuracy exactly how you're showing up in the world. And even in a soulmate type relationship, if you can tolerate that, there may be a lot of growth that occurs. But I'm not sure that that's what the meaning of life is. It's like we've been taught the meaning of life is a satisfying relationship. But if there's any truth in that at all, I'd say the meaning of life is satisfying relationship with yourself, and that requires finding out who you are, who you really are, not who you've been taught that you are, or not what your parents named you, but who you really are. So I would say that if I was going to put into words the meaning of life, it would be to really embrace your true identity. And that true identity is much more than we've been taught in this culture of a man or a woman or a beloved or a mother. Yeah, it's beyond all of this.
So then the question, of course, that comes up from that is, how do you discover that? How do you learn that?
Yes, well, here's another one of these wonderful paradoxes in that, you know, this experience of seeing who you really are beyond the personality is one which, yeah, sometimes we call enlightenment or, yeah, there's a whole series of names from different traditions for this. And sometimes this experience occurs when the individual wasn't seeking it at all or even wanting it. And even for a person who's totally dedicates their life to seeking, there's no guarantees. So I think orienting yourself in that way and asking the question, really, just, you know, self-inquiry, taking a look and seeing what you can see into this mystery is not necessary, but perhaps useful. And in the end, there's nothing we can do to make this happen. It's really a matter of grace. And so this idea of trying and striving and working and struggling turns out to not get us very far. Some people recommend various practices, different kinds of meditations, devotion, service. And these maybe point us in the right direction, but the mind is so clever at taking any task, any goal, and distorting it. So in a way, people might do better to just stop trying and be present.
You know, that's just perfect what you're saying, because I'm looking at my questions here and going, oh man, she's going into several of these questions. Which one can I get her into next? So what I want to direct you in, because you've been talking about this, but what would you consider our greatest distraction towards spiritual awakening and growth?
Well, different people, it's going to show up differently, but I think we could group all of these distractions into a box called addiction. That is, anything that we think we need to have in order to be okay, in order to be happy. So for some people, they look for happiness in some kind of substance. Other people look for happiness, or another word maybe would be escape from what they don't want to feel, in work. Some people, as I was discussing, look for that in sex or love or food. But whatever it is that you're using in order to feel better, instead of taking a good long look at where is the source of your discomfort or anxiety, that would be the distraction for you.
Interesting. You bring up the word addiction and you're applying it to anything that really takes your attention, which or takes an overly amount of attention, which is different than what many people think of when they use the word addiction. And I like what you've said about that.
Yeah. And, you know, granted, there is a distinction between a physical dependence on something, so that if the body doesn't get it, the body goes into shock. There's a difference between that and what we could call a psychological addiction of just some kind of behavior or reward that we're using to help ourselves feel better, to distract us from the source of discomfort. But they function the same way, even though one is physical, one is psychological, some may be both, in that they are keeping us from coming into direct contact with life.
Then let's go just the opposite direction and talk about what you would say is the greatest quality that humans possess.
The greatest quality that humans possess. Well, I'm afraid this is going to lead us into another open-ended conversation if I were to say consciousness. But maybe rather than saying consciousness, I'll say the capacity to be unconditionally accepting, or love could be another word, of whatever arrives in our life. And the thing that's always fascinated me is that people who have very difficult lives with a lot of traumatic events and challenges seem to not be at a disadvantage. People who are facing a lot of challenges, in fact, sometimes seem to have more capacity to simply surrender to what life is bringing and somehow survive it without contracting. Whereas people with much easier, privileged lives, the simplest little thing sometimes can throw them off and create this huge amount of resistance. So, but we all have, however easy or difficult our lives have been, we all have this capacity to unconditionally embrace, love, accept, meet whatever comes our way.
Deborah, that is a scary concept, to unconditionally embrace and accept whatever comes my way is pretty scary thought.
Well, it's a scary thought, and of course this doesn't mean that you know, someone steps on your toe that you can't yell or, you know, move your toe or ask them to get off of it. Yeah. It's not becoming a doormat, but it's also recognizing that what's occurring is occurring, and that if the possibility to change it is there, you can change it. But if it's not, there's nothing else you can do. What's scary is to keep trying to change something that can't be changed.
Do you think that goes along with taking personal responsibility for your life?
Absolutely, yeah. And again, we don't really have control over what happens in the world. What we may have control over is how we respond. And so responsibility is the same word. So personal responsibility is about how do we respond. And another area where people often get confused is they think personal responsibility means that if your house burns down and you had nothing to do with, you weren't playing with matches or something, you have nothing to do with this, an electric wire falls down and your house burns, that somehow this is your responsibility. It's not. But how you respond to that, that's your responsibility.
Well, that makes a lot of sense and is not quite as scary to me as fully embracing anything that comes my way. I think of a speeding train coming down the tracks and looking at it and going, this is my life? Oh, no!
Well, right. This is another source of a lot of misunderstanding. I mean, if a train's coming at you and you can jump out of the way, of course, jump.
I was thinking of the train. I was thinking of it as an allegory for my life.
Well, exactly. But, in that allegory, if you can jump out of the way, do it. If you're mm-hmm. chained to the track, then accept it. The closer I get to death, and of course, none of us knows when that will be, whatever our age, but the older you get, the chances are it's sooner rather than later. And the older I get, the more I realize that actually, coming back to purpose again, one way to think about what is my purpose here, my purpose is to die consciously. My purpose is to, without going around being obsessed about death all the time, but to actually be ready to die and therefore ready to live at any moment.
I like to call that sometimes living without regret. So thinking about if I were to die in my sleep tonight, what regrets would I have? What relationships are in limbo or have an issue that need to be dealt with? What do I need to take care of? Those kinds of things so that I wouldn't have any regrets.
Yeah, exactly. And not having regrets, this is certainly, and the thing about regrets is they keep us from being here and now. So not having any regrets is, taking away one of these distractions to being present. But it doesn't in and of itself guarantee that we can die consciously and without fear. And most of us are very afraid of dying. And if you look at that, you realize, well, what happens when you die? Well, first of all, we don't know. We may have some ideas about what we think will happen. But basically, we're entering into the unknown in a really big way. We just don't know. And the other thing is that we know that the body's going to die. And that, we can see that happening to other people. And so if your identity is in your body, and the body's going to die, then this is a really scary thing. But if your identity is not in the body or the personality, if you have recognized that you're actually something way beyond this physical manifestation, then it really shifts. It takes that fear away, is what seems to happen. If you're okay with the unknown and you're okay not being in the body, then really, what is it that could possibly, what is there to be afraid of?
I don't know if there's a certain age when people tend to get over that or work through it, or if it's a concept that we have to work through. I know, coming from a medical background, that the idea of death has never been, it has never been an issue for me. And I know some people have said, well, it isn't the dying that bothers me, it's the process of dying. But our whole life is that process, so that's saying you don't want to live.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Deborah, you've been giving us some wise words here, so I'm going to ask you about wisdom, what it is, and how do we gain wisdom? Because you're a wise woman now, you see.
Yes, well, I'm pretty sure that the reason I've become a wise woman is because I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, and I've learned from them. And yeah, the more mistakes that we make, the more opportunities we have to learn. Now, you could make a lot of mistakes and learn nothing from them, or you could live a long time and be so careful and never take any risks that you don't really give yourself the opportunity to learn anything. But wisdom to me seems to be a natural outcome of experiencing life and being aware of the cause and effect relationship between our actions and the consequences.
Well, that's a big one right there.
Yeah, yeah, and not so complicated, but it seems that to me that's the biggest difference between being younger and older is the amount of experiences that have been there.
It reminds me of a cartoon I saw on Facebook within the past couple of days that says the difference between a master and a beginner. The master is somebody who has failed more times than the beginner has even thought about having it all.
Yes, that's an even better way to put it. That's really sums it up, doesn't it?
It does. Let's move to another direction here. I want to talk about the world situation for a minute, which may not be comfortable, but there you go. So the question is, does the world situation and the economic situation throughout the world have spiritual roots? What do you think about that?
Does it have spiritual roots? Is that what?
Yeah.
Well, I think you could say that the situation is the outcome of some people's efforts, to reject spirituality. And by spirituality, I mean the recognition that we're all one. We're all part of the same larger being. There is really no existence for anyone apart from the whole. So many of the things that are happening in the world would be inconceivable and impossible if humanity was really aware of and desiring to live from this recognition that all is one. Because the truth is that as long as any of us are suffering, are hungry, are exploited, oppressed, impoverished, yeah, as long as anyone's basic needs are not met, then none of us can really have a sense of peace. And I think that's the bottom line. So in that sense, yes, a spiritual awakening at this point, I'm quite convinced is the only possibility of shifting the paradigm that we're living in, which says it's okay for a very small minority of the people to have access to a very large majority of the resources. This is insanity.
Then let's look at some of the leadership positions that are in our world. And you're talking about a spiritual awakening. How about leadership and how any one of us, no matter what our position is in the world, leaders or not, can develop genuine spiritual leadership?
I think that we don't need to concern ourselves so much with leadership in that if you're spiritually grounded, if you're spiritually awakened, and that's, you know, means not only recognizing your identity encompasses all and everything, but also that you are listening to guidance. Yeah, if there's no need for the mind really to get concerned about leadership, because leadership will naturally happen if people are attuned to their purpose. So in a small sphere, say in the sphere of your personal body, you know, we could all be the leaders of our personal bodies, and that means listening to the body. What does the body want and need, and helping the body get that? And for some people, they are intended and equipped to serve that function for larger numbers of people, but not so much because they think they should, but because that's just naturally how they move in the world.
I like your idea about being the leadership of your body and listening to your body. I think that's a place that we could all start, no matter what our position in the world is.
Yeah. And if you can't listen to your body and serve your body, you're certainly not going to be able to do much for other people.
That's a good point.
Yeah, you know, part of my mission in life has been to encourage people to be more embodied, to be aware of what's going on in the body, what the body wants and needs, to find ways to experience pleasure in the body, to expand rather than contract in the face of uncomfortable sensations, whether they're physical or emotional. So, yeah, this is what I'm saying. Peace begins in the bedroom, and actually beyond that, peace begins in your own body.
That's a really good point. I'm going to move us completely in another direction, Deborah, and I want to talk about money. I've got three questions here, and I'm going to ask you all three of them at once. You can answer them however you would like. First one is being a spiritual leader and having wealth compatible and possible? And what keeps so many spiritual practitioners from financial wealth? And how can a spiritual leader or practitioner let go of poverty and grow into wealth?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start by saying that from my own experience in life, whenever I have been on purpose, that is listening to guidance and surrendering to what's in front of me to do that I'm being called to do, whenever I've done that, I've always been supported financially. And in fact, this has become kind of a real feedback loop for me. And when I say supported financially, that hasn't meant great wealth necessarily, but it's meant that my needs are met, and my needs for quality of life as well as for cash. So I would say anyone who's consistently struggling financially really needs to take a look at what are they doing. And it may be that what they're doing is directed more from an idea or a concept they have than actually listening to what's being asked for. I also, when I hear this question, I think of something that a dear friend and mentor once said, Joe Dominguez, who's no longer in the body, but who taught me a lot about money. And he wrote a book back in the 90s after a couple of decades of offering a seminar called Your Money or Your Life, Transforming Your Relationship with Money. And I think what happened for a lot of well-meaning people is that they've seen how greed and hoarding and selfishness has a negative effect in the world. But they've concluded from this that the problem is money, that money is evil, where money is quite neutral. It's all about what you do with the money or don't do with the money that you have control over. And so what he said is, you know, if you're there thinking money is evil and hating money, a dollar is not going to want to stay in your pocket. You know, if you were a dollar, do you want to stick with someone who hates you? Of course not. So I see a lot of well-meaning spiritual people perhaps are sabotaging themselves financially by this belief that money is evil. And, money is energy. Money is time. So if we want to use our time and energy to help others, then the more of it we have, the better, the more good we can do in the world. So I don't see any difficulty at all with having a lot of resources. What seems to create an imbalance situation is if we don't know how much is enough for our personal needs, and or we try to address our fear of dying by collecting a lot of money. And, those things don't work out so well.
We're going to move on here. I don't want to overtake us on time, so I'm going to keep moving this along. Would you mind telling us about a time when you felt really overwhelmed or close to burnout? What got you through it and what you learned from the experience?
Well, there have been many such times in my life. And I think, maybe the most pivotal one of those experiences was back much earlier in my life when I was a single parent, and I had just finished graduate school in clinical psychology when one of these big recessions hit. And there was I applied for job after job after job, and there was just no way that I could land a job as a new PhD. I was overqualified for many of the existing jobs, and I was underqualified for the jobs that I hoped to land. And I was kind of getting down to, my last dollar. I've got this child to take care of, and I really just didn't know what to do. But I decided that, I'd better get some money coming in somehow. And so the best paying job that I could find at the time was house cleaning. So I took a job house cleaning, and I wasn't making a lot of money, but kind of enough to keep a roof over our heads and food on the table. And I was, doing my best at this job, and things seemed to be, moving along okay. And then one day I came home, and I had just gotten paid. I had some money in my bag. And someone actually climbed up a tree, jumped onto the balcony of my room, went into my room, and stole my purse.
Oh, no.
This felt like absolutely the last straw.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm really humbling myself here, cleaning other people's toilets just to feed my child, and I finally make a few bucks, and somebody steals it. And this is what I mean about unconditionally accepting, is that really kind of took me down to, and there are a few other things going on which I won't go into, but that really kind of took me down to, okay, there's nothing I can do here but surrender. And, one of my spiritual teachers likes to say that we are human copying machines. And so whatever fears and whatever imprints we're carrying, perhaps back many generations, this is what we tend to produce in our world. So I had produced a situation in which I was completely broke and hopeless and helpless and had no one to turn to. And it kind of took that level of intensity for me to finally release that pattern. And I can't exactly explain how I did it, but there was nowhere to go but inside to the core source of this pattern and to embrace it and release it. And after that, things just started getting better. And it sounds kind of like magic and kind of woo-woo, but that's actually how it worked. And I've had, similar things happen where, because I've been a risk taker all my life, so I've gone out on a lot of limbs, and the limb breaks, and everything yep. I ever wanted to experience is, there surrounding me. And what I've learned is that the more you surrender, the better it is.
I think that's going to lead us into this question about powerful feminine leadership, because I don't know if this is a more masculine or feminine tendency of surrendering, but let's talk about powerful women, powerful feminine spiritual leadership, what it looks like and why it's important.
Well, it's important, I'll say, first of all, because it's kind of an endangered species. You know, we don't really have many examples, and I think this is why it's taken me kind of a long time to find my way. Although very early on in my life, I had the good fortune to attend a weekend seminar that was led by a woman named Gay Luce. And she's still around, I believe, although I haven't heard much from her lately, but I think I would have heard if she died. And Gay Luce was leading this group from in a very feminine way. And when I saw her leading in this way, for the first time, I went, ah, okay, I can do that. And I'm leading groups now for, you know, over 40 years since that moment, when I saw a woman leading in a way that was not super directive. And yeah, most women who are leaders, and not that there's anything wrong with this, but are leading in much the same way that men do. That is, from a place of being very directive and being entertaining and being dominating. And that's an effective leadership style. There's nothing wrong with that style, and I've, you know, cultivated some of that over time, but have learned more and more and been appreciated for it more and more as time goes on, is that leadership can be very gentle. Leadership can be really more about listening and reflecting back what is perceived and holding the space. And that's a popular term. I'm not sure everyone understands exactly what it means, but for now I'll just leave it at holding the space, the container in which all kinds of creative activities and harmonious activities can happen when the container is there. And when it's not, gentle reminder, not a confrontation or shaming, that someone has moved away from the synergy of the group. Feminine leadership is relational. It's really about paying attention to all the relationships in the field and to being aware of a harmony and a balance, a reciprocity that exists. And many of the indigenous cultures pay a lot of attention to and hold very sacred this idea of reciprocity, which means that in a group, there needs to be an equivalent amount of giving and receiving by everyone, and whether that group is two people or a million people, that doesn't change. And so feminine leadership really tracks the level of reciprocity to see that everyone is giving and receiving in a balanced way.
That's beautiful. It's a beautiful description of it. I heard somebody recently call it feminine leadership as holding the space, as holding the container. So things can happen within that space, within that container. And I love the idea of the reciprocity, so that everybody gets heard an equal amount of the time, or everybody gets heard, their voice gets heard, their concerns get heard and addressed, rather than just being told this is how it's going to be, so get with it.
There's a place for both. You know, groups that try to operate through consensus decision making all the time are notorious for being very inefficient and taking a lot of time. And some are just not that important. It's much more efficient for an expert to look at it and say, oh, this is how to do it. But other things, it really is essential that everyone have a voice. And so to know the difference and when to use which method and to be able to stay present to whatever is showing up in the field. And we come back to this again. Recently I did a group where one of the people in the group had some really big emotions coming up and had been through some very traumatic experiences. And all I did was to just be with that. And again, hold the container in which it was possible, not only for him, but for the whole group to feel what was coming up. And that's all that was needed. You know, it was not any kind of technique or manipulation or any glamorous activity, but just being there for what couldn't be felt, couldn't be heard, to arise and be let go.
That's pretty powerful for an entire group to be able to experience that.
Yeah. And much more powerful than if it had just been, you know, me and this other person. But to have that witnessed by the whole group and, you know, the leadership of it was to hold the space so that people who never would have imagined that they could have done that were able to do it.
Well, Deborah, now we're coming down to the wire on our time. So I have two more questions I'd like to ask you. And at the end of that, I'm going to ask you for your contact information. But let's go back to this. The first question is, the book is meant for people who are already on their path, on their spiritual path, and they're now working with others who are just awakening. So they are the newer teachers and leaders in our world. And what would you say to somebody in that group who wants to deepen their connection with spirit even more? So they're already on a spiritual path, but they want to deepen their connection more. What would you say to them?
First of all, to take time to be still, whether that's being in nature or in meditation or some art or activity they enjoy, but to really hold sacred this time to stay connected with themselves. I think often this is the first thing that goes when people embark on some big project, whether it's career or teaching or whatever, is to give away all of themselves. And so the first thing I would say is that really prioritizing enough time to nurture yourself, to stay connected with spirit. And the second thing would be to find a mentor. Or if they have a mentor, yeah, even though they feel, okay, I don't really need a teacher anymore, I know what to do now, it's still important to have some connection with someone who's a little further along.
Sure agree with that one. I think that we can all use a mentor no matter where we are, no matter how advanced we are along the path. that we can all use a mentor, somebody who's been walking there before we.
Absolutely.
My next question, Deborah, would be, what would you say to encourage these pathfinders and leaders who are helping others to begin their spiritual walk?
Well, you know, I'm not coming up with anything. I think maybe because I suspect they've already begun their spiritual walk. And in fact, that they're quite committed to the spiritual walk. So I'm not sure that I would need to tell them anything other than, just keep going for it.
And find that mentor, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Deborah, I want to thank you very much for your time today and for joining me in this interview. I need to ask you about your contact information. Would you please tell us, for anybody who wants to get a hold of you, what you have? It's a website or email, phone number, or what you'd like to share.
Okay. My email address is Taj, T as in Tom, A, J as in Jack, at lovewithoutlimits.com, and that's probably the best way to get a hold of me, Taj at lovewithoutlimits.com. And then the lovewithoutlimits.com is my website. It's got a lot of audio, video, articles, as well as upcoming events. And then I have a new site, pelvicheart.com, which is all about the pelvic heart integration work.
Oh, nice. We haven't heard about that. Do you want to take a minute and tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. The pelvic heart integration work is, that's my current mission. It's not work that I created. One of my mentors, Jack Painter, who's no longer in the body, developed this amazing synthesis of mind, body, spiritual, sexual, ancestral, really just every level that you could imagine transformation happening on. And all of these levels woven together into an integrated whole. So this is truly holistic transformational work. And it's the core of the work is really about harmonizing the inner masculine, the inner feminine, or harmonizing the heart and the pelvis, or harmonizing mind and body. And it covers absolutely everything from clearing ancestral patterns to seeing how we can raise the next generation in a good way. I'm currently training people in this work, and they're going to be offering it to the general public, which I'm going to be stepping away from. And it's just amazing work. There's more information about it at the website. So anyone who's looking for a really powerful way to shift dysfunctional patterns and to find a sense of inner harmony and to reclaim their sexuality from all of the thousands of years of distorted messages that have been heaped onto it. And this is the place to go.
All right. Thank you for sharing that. And thanks again for your time with this interview. Is there anything else that we haven't addressed that you would like to make sure that gets delivered or spoken of today?
No, I think you've been quite comprehensive in your questions, so I'm happy to leave it here.
All right. Well, for a third time, thank you very much. It's been great to have you with me today.
You're very welcome.
Once again, this is Jan Revelle with an interview with Deborah Annapol. You can learn more about Deborah at www.womenspiritualleaders.com, where you can also learn more about the book and the other amazing women who are featured in the book. You can contact me at jan@womenspiritualleaders.com. Thanks for listening.